Good morning and welcome to Focus on Health, the weekly radio program where we talk about all the great things happening at Van Deest Medical Center. I am your host, Lori Foster, and today we will hear part two of provider Jade Williams sharing her story as a patient with ovarian cancer. Before we do, I have just a few announcements I'd like to share. We had several celebrations taking place last week, the first being that Van Deest Medical Center has earned the designation of a top 100 critical access hospital status for 2024. This award is compiled by the Chartis Center for Rural Health and is an annual recognition program which honors outstanding performance among the nation's rural hospitals based on the results of the Chartis Rural Hospital Performance Index. This marks the second year that Van Deest Medical Center has achieved the top 100 critical access hospital status. Our hospital is one of only 12 hospitals in the state of Iowa to receive this designation. Secondly, congratulations to Van Deest Medical Center's Senior Life Solutions for being named the 2023 Most Improved One-Track Program. Out of 133 one-track programs, Van Deest Medical Center's Senior Life Solutions achieved the recognition for its outstanding performance in the three C's, which are care, compliance, and community. Congratulations to Senior Life Solutions. And lastly, very exciting news, Van Deest Medical Center has achieved a 5-star patient survey rating. The patient survey rating measures patients' experiences with their hospital care. Recently discharged patients were asked about important topics like how well the nurses and doctors communicated, how responsive hospital staff were to their needs, and the cleanliness and quietness of the hospital environment. Thank you to all of our patients for trusting Van Deest Medical Center with your health care. Now here's Jade sharing more of her journey navigating ovarian cancer.
Mine is a subtype of epithelial. It's called clear cell carcinoma. So it is aggressive and it's on the outside of the ovary, which makes it bad because then it's sharing its cancer cells with every other tissue that it comes into contact with. A good analogy that we have used is that, you have cancer and it's in one spot, but it's just kind of like going to the airport. That cancer is hanging out at the airport, but it has an intention to go or can go somewhere else. And it's just a matter of time. When is it going to get on that plane and like take off? So mine, we checked the fluid that was in my pelvis then at that time, and it came back suspicious. And so then that's what made it even more concerning, was that it was on the outside of the ovary and then it's in your pelvic washings. So whatever was touching the pelvic fluid has now been exposed to this aggressive subtype of cancer. And so when we went back for the follow-up, he said, you're going to heal up from this within 4 weeks, and then we're going to have you need to consider a second surgery. The beauty was Ryan and I weren't having any more children after the, complications that I had with both of mine previously. So we knew that it was okay to take it. We didn't need to preserve anything necessarily. And so that made it a little easier for us, but that can be an extremely difficult situation for patients, is that they have to decide, can they preserve an ovary so that they can eventually have children, or what does that look like? And it's still putting you at risk for keeping those things. So we scheduled the second surgery for November 20th, right before Thanksgiving. And so that one was, I think some people tend to think of a hysterectomy as, not a real major surgery, but, so I had a total hysterectomy with then my right ovary and fallopian tube being removed in addition to just your uterus and your cervix. And then I had a layer of tissue that sits on top of your your intestines. It's called your omentum. So they removed that too, because that's basically like a sponge. It sucks up the fluid that was in the pelvis and kind of washes your intestines and your lower lung with the potential of the cancer. And then they took like 21 lymph nodes, periaortic lymph nodes, so lymph nodes that are attached to your aorta, and then other. So I think I had a total of like 31 tissue samples that was taken with the second surgery, and then, you know, a total hysterectomy. So I did have to have like I would call it like a lap-assisted hysterectomy, because I did have to have an abdominal incision as well. So I had like a total of 5 incisions with the second surgery. But it was a relief to me that he was able to modify it and didn't have to do a full abdominal open case, because, I mean, that's just extremely, you know, there's a potential for a lot of complications with something like that. And then he did keep me in the hospital for like pain management after that, just because of the level of surgery that was done. So, so then we did everything, and I got put into surgical menopause on November 20th. And what that basically means is, you know, you take your ovaries, and so you no longer have really your two primary sources of estrogen. And so that's a scary thing too, being, you know, 38 years old and being pushed into menopause abruptly. You know, your body typically goes through that in a very gradual period of time. And so just to have that done, it does put you at a greater risk for like osteoporosis and cardiovascular issues and dementia and different things like that. And so that's, as a provider, that's where my mind went, was trying to like preserve my mind and maintain my mood without being able to have additional hormones and things like that. You know, there are some women who unfortunately will experience like mood swings and depression and different things like that after it happens. But thankfully, I think I've had just a good support system, and my children keep me busy and active and engaged, that I, you know, everybody that knows what happened or was aware of what was happening, you know, they're like, you're still the same person that you were before surgery. You know, and my kids don't say that I yell at them or anything like that. So that's good. But yeah, so that part thankfully has been preserved. So then that has made me more optimistic that things will just continue to get better. So that's always a blessing. But yeah, so then we had the surgery on, like I said, the 20th, and I went back to him for my follow-up. I had one, I think, after 2 weeks. It was actually on my birthday, December 5th. I had a follow-up with him, and then my last follow-up with him was on the 20th. But the crazy thing is obviously nobody wants to be told they have cancer or one that is a rare subtype, and they really don't have good treatment for it. But here's the things we're going to try to do to preserve life. But like my little girl, Finley, she was in the Nutcracker, and it sounds really probably crazy to people, but I was able to enjoy and do that entire week with her. I got to go to every single dress rehearsal. I got to be there for all 3 performances, all of that. And unfortunately, I would have had to choose, had I still been working, between taking off the week of Christmas and being home with them, or getting to take that week off and actually really being able to do that with her. And so that has been an actual blessing, you know, to be honest. And she loved it. And she had, you know, at that time, my children had no idea that I actually, why I, mom had had these surgeries and why mom's life had changed a little bit and why mom wasn't at work. At that time, Finley had held on that I was going to come back to work around December 11th. That's what I was shooting for. And so she kept that date And she'd be like, so you're going back on the 11th. And, you know, well, when are you going back? And why are you going back? And just different things like that. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. You know, after we visited with Dr. Elge and talked about what we were dealing with, you know, his big push was, which I'm very thankful for, was you need to not try to rush back to work, because you really can't do anything but walk on flat surfaces right now. I mean, I had to be released to even do stairs for the Nutcracker with him, and that was concerning. I couldn't lift anything more than 10 pounds. His concern was exposure to infection, and then also just, he could tell by my personality. He's like, what are you going to do? If there's something that happens, you can't rush into your patient's room. You can't be there. You'd have to be standing off and back. And he's like, you just don't have that personality. He's like, you'll get into it and you'll think it's going to be fine. And then we're going to have, unfortunately, a complication for that, which is just going to push you back even more. So, like, let's just take the time and, you know, focus on these things so that you have a good recovery. And then when I seen him on the 20th of December, you know, that's when he gave us the big push for the chemotherapy. And, you know, he basically told me, if we didn't do it, we were crazy, is what he said. Because in my mind, I was like, well, if you've already taken it and the washings weren't confirmed, but they're suspicious, which unfortunately in our world we err then that it is a positive, you know, then what's the point in doing the chemotherapy? Let's just see what happens. And he said, you know, you're crazy if you don't go forward with the chemotherapy. And so then he referred us to Dr. Lucanville, and we met with him on January 10th. And then we set up for the first round of treatment, which was on the 31st of this month, of January, sorry. So up to this point, I'd like to say that chemo was fine, but it's different for everybody. And unfortunately, they recommended I also have a port placed. And so we did that on the 22nd of January, and the port itself went fine, but I had a reaction to the vancomycin, which was the antibiotic they gave me. I developed like red man syndrome, which is something as a provider you never want your patient to experience with vancomycin. And so now I can still get it. It's a reaction. It's an allergic reaction. You can still get vanco. It's just at a much lower rate for the medication. So if I do need it down the road, I could still have it, and or they could pre-medicate me with, you know, like steroids or something like that. But I'm going to be optimistic that I won't have the need to have vancomycin anywhere in the near future. So I had an allergic reaction essentially after the port. We got through that. We knew what was coming up. I got the blessing. This is something else. This is not for everybody by any means, but my physician and team thought that it was a good option for me. It's something that's being studied at Mayo. They've been doing their own studies. University of San Diego has been studying what's called a fasting mimicking diet that you do before you take chemo. And so like for mine, I started it on a Saturday, or I apologize, Sunday, and had chemo on Wednesday. And the goal is that you do your fasting mimicking diet. So it's very specific foods in a certain amount that you're getting for those 3 days. And then you're supposed to continue it the day of treatment and the day after. And it's supposed to help with a couple things. It creates a level of what they call autophagy. So like where you have these senescent cells that they're kind of like, maybe you've heard of zombie cells or something like that. So in our bodies, sometimes our system doesn't necessarily clear things out like it's supposed to, or that's kind of the basis behind this. And so you get these sleeper cells or senescent cells, which we used to think was actually meant only for somebody aging or advanced age. But now we're finding from studies that it can happen at any age, that you get these sleeper cells. And so the fasting mimicking diet, essentially it causes enough stress on your body that it causes these cells to decide what they're going to do. Like if they're waking up or if they're going to get flushed out, that type of thing. And so it's supposed to help with the treatment that I'm getting, the chemo treatment, the two kinds that I have, the Taxol and the Carboplatin. And then it's also supposed to help with the side effects from the chemotherapy. But I broke the fast the night before treatment and decided I wanted to be able to enjoy a good meal with my family and just like enjoy a pop, because chemotherapy can affect the way you taste things, and it can also affect even the way like your appetite, and it can affect like how food tastes and just all of that. So I broke the fast after 3 days, went in and had chemo on the January 31st, and the treatment itself did not, in my opinion, go well, but by my physician and his team, they said it was fine because the treatment got finished. But I had a pretty significant reaction to the chemotherapy, and required like rescue meds and just like all of this. And so that was just a traumatic situation. And they had prepared me that there was a potential for a reaction, but we were hoping, because I had pre-medicated with like a steroid, heavy steroid, the night before and the day of, and then they give you other pre-meds like histamine blockers and things like that to try to dampen your immune system so that it doesn't have a reaction when you start to take this foreign substance into your body. But unfortunately, in my case, my immune system just went off the rails and it decided it didn't like what was happening. And so now I'm trying to be very optimistic that with the second round on the 21st, that it will, it'll go much better, which we're going to try some different medications and a different regimen, and hopefully it'll, you know, work out, but we'll see. So the chemo itself, after the treatment, it was like, you know, 5 days that I really didn't feel like myself and felt like I had the flu, like a really bad case of the flu, like bone pain and fatigue, and just, you know, one of the days I tried making my bed and that wore me out to the point where I had to like lay down, which was new for me because I'm not used to, you know, being wore out from something like that. Or like one day I got up and took a shower and then I forced myself to go outside for a walk and pushed it and walked a mile. And then as soon as I came back, I had to lay on the couch. And I was like, oh, I'm just gonna like fall asleep. I can't. I don't even have a choice. I have to go to sleep now. And I, you know, overdid it to myself. So anyway, that's where we're at today. I think it's just kind of therapeutic. I mean, I don't want to say like I'm putting it out there, but I really think if I can help somebody, that's really the goal from this. I mean, I can't imagine, had I not been tracking it on my phone, how long I actually would have probably let this go. I mean, even by the second half marathon, you know, I took a picture of Ryan and I before we went out to run the race, because he ran it with me, and I look at it and I'm like, I look like I'm 3 months pregnant. I do not look like somebody that had been training for one, let alone two, for the year, or been consistently taking care of themselves. In my opinion, that's how it looks to me. But I also know where my body had been physically up to this situation really kind of transpiring. And, you know, so that's frustrating, that I was working so hard to take care of myself, mm-hmm. that, and then it kind of sabotaged me in this, you know, and this is the situation where we're at. But it's also so amazing and crazy what the body is actually capable of. And being a provider and seeing that day in and day out with my patients, but also now being a patient myself and seeing the things and the stress and just the different medication, going from somebody who never takes medication to having, you know, something that you can look at chemo as being a poison, you know, and that's how I feel like I worry some people look at it like that. But realistically, if you look at chemotherapy, it is really amazing what they are able to do. I mean, the certain one, the Taxol that I take, you know, the nurse practitioner with Dr. Lucanville office who I see, she informed me she's been doing this for over 30 years. And she said, you know, when we started using Taxol, when she started 30 years ago, she said, you'd have to stay in the hospital and we'd give it over a minimum of a 24-hour period of time because of how concerning it was and how we needed to watch the patient. And she's like, and now we can infuse you in an afternoon. Like, and then, you know, do you feel crummy? Yes, but you also have to think on a cellular level what this medication is doing. I mean, it's redoing your DNA, which is a little sci-fi and scary sometimes. You know, but it's literally like just forcing a regeneration. It's a reset is kind of how I've come to think of it. Like it's resetting these rogue cells that's in my body. And is there going to be some collateral? Probably, you know, one of those being my hair, others being like my concern for what we call like neuropathy. So like you're in your hands and your feet, but I've also had a great support system. And one of those is another survivor. She didn't even know me or knew of me. And she's reached out and she checks in on me and she's brought over stuff. Like she did these cold, they're called like, I call them cold packs. I guess I don't really know what they are, but it's a cold therapy. And so for the Taxol treatment, it's supposed to be around 3 hours. You put these gloves on that look like grill mitts that are have ice packs inside of them that cool your hands to a certain temperature, and then your feet. And you tape your feet with these bands so that the packs, the ice, is, you know, as tight as it possibly can be to your toes. So you're basically freezing your hands and feet for 3 hours with the potential of basically you're causing such significant vasoconstriction that the medication, it's going to circulate there, right? We're not completely occluding off the area, but it's to try and help prevent the side effect of neuropathy so that I don't lose the ability to feel the need to button something, or I can pick up my cup and not like drop it on the ground because I don't even realize. Or, you know, there's been stories where there's women who are very active and then they get this neuropathy in their feet and they can't run or they can't do anything because maybe even drive because it causes such a significant impact. And so, you know, if I can do something that's going to minimize it and it's not a medication, I'm willing to try that because ultimately I want to try and preserve, you know, my kidneys and my liver and my heart and, you know, all those things as much as I can. But just also the community in general, like the hospital has been so supportive. It's been extremely difficult. I've been out of work since October 20th. That's the last day I closed my office, knowing that I wouldn't be back at least for 6 to 8 weeks. And, you know, here we are, it's February now. I'm slotted to do 6 rounds total of treatment. So my last regimen or my last treatment won't be until May, like middle of May, if everything goes well. You know, and so just trying to figure out what that's going to look like, you know, if I can come back to work and work a little bit here or there. I think just to add some normalcy to my life would be nice. But then also there's just a huge fear of, well, what if that ends up being a bad day? And then, you know, I don't like letting people down. And I know everybody would understand, but it would just be like me feeling like I was letting everybody down. Like the one day I'm supposed to, you know, come back or do a round or something like that. And I can't do it, you know, because I'm feeling so crummy or whatever. So I think just really figuring out what that's going to look like. And like I said, I can't ask for a better place to work to be dealing with this. You know, I can't imagine trying to do this in any other type of employment that I've had. So, you know, that's been great. And then also just the community that was shown to my children, they didn't even know why. They knew mom had surgeries, but they didn't know why people were just sending flowers to the house, or why there was little gift baskets showing up at the door, or, you know, different things like that, or people popping over just to check in, or stuff like that. And it's, you know, it just shows them that there's good in the world and that people do care. And I think that's a privilege living in a small community, because, you know, if we, unfortunately, in my opinion, if I lived in, say, Des Moines, I don't know that we would have that level of support at all. But we did choose to tell the girls about the chemo finally and cancer in general after we talked with Dr. Luke and Bill, when we knew it was going to get closer to the actual treatment and I had to have the port put in. We decided to share it with them. And, you know, there was a lot of tears. And, you know, Finley, she's become very quiet, but she'll sporadically ask me, you know, different questions. Like last night, she, out of nowhere, she just told me that she thought I was brave. And I don't know if she'll ever know how much that actually means to me, her saying that, because, you know, I don't feel brave. I feel like I do a lot of journaling, and I really just try to stay positive and optimistic. But if she knew how scared I was, then, you know, I've wrote so many times, though, like, knowing I'm going through it, and I'm a young person in my mind, you know, I'm 38, yeah. Then it makes, like, and how scared I am, and the side effects, and just navigating it, and all of that, and the cancer center I'm with is Mission, and they have an excellent team, and they have all these resources, and it's great, and they constantly call and check in on me, and see how things are going, and I love that, and they're always giving me advice or, you know, different things like that. I mean, I can get in touch with my doctor's nurse at any time. I send her an email, she emails me back with a response, or even a phone call if I need it. And so, but then I get, my heart starts to hurt for the older patients that go through this, because I can't imagine, you know, here I am talking about running, you know, a couple races and working out and things like that. Well, physically, I would think I'm a strong person from a physical standpoint, but the amount of fatigue that I've experienced already from just one round of chemo. And so I do think, you know, I have a challenge in general for any a cancer provider or cancer research would be, like, they need to do better. I mean, they can always do better. We're taking people at their most vulnerable time, and we're asking them to trust in something that's only, unfortunately, going to have side effects and bring about, you know, days that they really don't have maybe the ability to even care for themselves, depending on where they were already at in their life. And so, I mean, that's just makes me very sad. I've already projected that ethical soapbox onto my doctor and his team. So we're doing the best that we can, which they are. They're doing, you know, everything that they can, and they provide whatever is needed to help, like, minimize the symptoms within their ability, you know. But the reality is that there's just, like, certain things, you know, that they just can't do. We're not there yet. You know, in my case, we're still looking for clinical trials for me. So that's also kind of part of it that makes me nervous about making a plan for coming back to work yet. Because if I get put in a clinical trial, we're only going to be adding more different types of chemo agents into the mix, which obviously comes with side effects. And, you know, which then just makes it a little more difficult to navigate life Finley has, she's in competition dance, and so she has several competitions coming up in March and in April, and then they have recital, her and Halston, Halston's my four-year-old, they have recital coming up in May, and it's, I don't want to miss out, you know, on any of that stuff. I'm not going to allow myself to do that, so saving my energy, I guess, is what I'm saying for those types of things is definitely, you know, a priority right now on my list.
Jade's story can be heard in full length on our new podcast channel. You can access it directly at vdmc.podbean.com or by going to our website at vandeastmc.org and selecting Focus on Health under the News and Events tab. Other ways to listen are through your favorite podcast app like Amazon Music, Audible, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts. Watch for more details about the launch of our podcast channel on our social media channels. That will do it for today's edition of Focus on Health, brought to you by Van Deese Medical Center, where our focus is you.